tiger!
Order, order.
Hello, I'm Hinea Ahu, bringing you The Week in Parliament with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon. The House resumed at 2pm on Tuesday after a week's adjournment. They'll be sitting for 3 weeks, most of which will be taken up with the debate on the budget. That debate, set down to last 15 hours, begins after Finance Minister Bill English delivers his 7th budget, which will be the first item of business on Thursday. He can take as long as he likes to deliver his budget. The debate is then launched by the Leader of the Opposition, who's followed by the Prime Minister. They can speak for 20 minutes each. Then all following speakers can have 10 minutes. The debate traditionally ends in a vote in which the House is required to express its confidence in the government, which of course has the majority to ensure that happens. Before the budget, on Thursday, there'll be questions as usual for ministers on Tuesday and Wednesday. Among them are bound to be more questions about the Auckland housing market, and that, as Tom Fruin reports, was the hot topic at the only select committee meeting during the adjournment.
Hello, I'm Tom Fruin. I'm on Bowen Street in Wellington at the intersection with the terrace. Behind me are the Beehive and Parliament. Ahead on one corner is the Treasury and on the other is the Reserve Bank. It's about 2 minutes walk, all downhill, to Bowen House on Lambton Quay, where the Reserve Bank Governor, Graham Wheeler, and his deputy, Grant Spencer, had an appointment at 1:10 on Wednesday. They were there well ahead of time to answer questions about the bank's financial stability report, published that morning at 9:00. Pretty much the same crowd that went to hear them do that at the Reserve Bank then followed them into the committee room number 2 in Bowen House, where they faced questions from MPs on the Finance and Expenditure Committee, including Labour's finance spokesman, Grant Robertson, who was interested in the measures they'd announced that morning to raise the minimum deposit to 30% for house buyers in Auckland, specifically aimed to take some of the heat out of the city's residential property market.
Do you think there is a risk in having put forward restrictions around speculators who are using the New Zealand banking system that you might be making it easier for foreign speculators, cash speculators, to be involved in the market? Is that a risk of the policy you've announced today?
Reserve Bank Governor Graham Wheeler said that their main concern was the financial stability of the country's banking system.
That's our responsibility, to think about those financial stability risks. So that's where our focus is.
Sure, but did you consider the fact that you could be effectively creating a loophole by which you would encourage further foreign speculation?
Well, to the extent that there's less aggressive competition, if you like, from investors, that gap could be filled by, you know, various parties. You know, hopefully we'll see more first-home buyers, for example, get access to the market.
Yeah, I take that point that that's the hope, but I guess the concern is that given we don't know the facts about foreign speculation, but we can make some judgments that it is possible that there would be potentially more room for that class. And isn't.
Across the table from Mr Robertson, Nationals Hunua MP Andrew Bailey was concerned about the impact on local first home buyers.
Just a piece of clarification. So all these the three changes you've announced, none of this relates to people buying their first house or a new development, a house that's just been built?
Mr Bailey's question was addressed by the Deputy Governor, Grant Spencer.
So for new construction, as under the existing LVR restriction, there's an exemption for loans for new construction or for purchasing an apartment off the plan.
Grant Spencer said people buying new homes from builders would be subject to the existing deposit restrictions, which didn't fully address Mr Bailey's concerns.
Don't you think we've got a slight disconnect? Because here we've got a government absolutely focused on increasing the supply of new properties, getting new houses into the market, and there's a possibility by maybe looking at how those rules are applied to make sure that we're getting people, first-time buyers often will be buying those properties, and to make sure that they're not disadvantaged.
Well, the bank, since the rule came in, since the exemption came in, have been marketing that product more, and have been more and more new first-home buyers have been, buying off the plan or at the construction phase in order to obtain the exemption. So those numbers have been increasing.
Grant Spencer later switched mics to let his boss answer this question from the Greens co-leader, Russell Norman.
Why do you think the heads of all the banks don't think that there's a problem with house prices in Auckland? And you do? Seriously. I mean, you could... Sorry, I don't mean to sound like I'm, you know, trying to stir the pot, but from the bank's point of view, obviously they make money from lending, right? So they want to lend more, but they must also recognise that if there's a big correction in Auckland, that's a problem for the banks as well. But they all are literally all saying that you've got it wrong.
Graham Wheeler didn't agree with that.
I'm not sure they're saying we've got it wrong. I have heard some of them say that they don't want to describe the Auckland market as a bubble, and we wouldn't use that language either. But I think they realise that there's a significant supply-demand imbalance and that house prices are severely stretched. That's certainly true from some of the conversations that we've had with them privately.
Graham Wheeler described the risk that the Auckland housing market posed to financial stability as substantial in giving this detailed answer to a question from National's Chris Bishop, the Deputy Chairman of the Finance and Expenditure Committee.
I'm just interested in teasing out, you know, what the specific risks to financial stability are from Auckland house prices.
Well, I think they're very substantial. I mean, if you look at mortgage commitments, they're growing at around 20%. You know, house prices in Auckland are growing at around 17%. They've been growing in the rest of the country over the last year at around 2%. If you look at house prices to disposable income in Auckland, that ratio is 7.4%. For the rest of the country, it's 4.2%. If you look at rental yields in Auckland, they're at historic lows, which suggests that there's a lot of people basically investing for capital gain, whereas the rental yields across the country are basically where they have been for the last 10 years. You look at the median house price in Auckland, it's up 60% since 2008. We had the highest rate of house price inflation in the OECD from 2003 to 2008. So the median house price in Auckland is now 60% above that. You look at the demographia survey that was done last year. We were 14th out of 370 housing markets around the world in terms of affordability. You look at the survey that was done by ANZ Bank in terms of investor expectations late last year. Basically, investors in Auckland were forecasting that house prices would increase by 75% over the next 5 years. Now, our job is to try and keep inflation on average at around 2% per annum. So that's just a phenomenal increase in house prices that are anticipated, and that would just drive house price to disposable income ratios up at a huge rate. So there's a whole range of reasons why there are major, I think, financial stability risks around Auckland. We don't use the word housing bubble or rockstar economy, but look, I've seen this a couple of times. I saw it in the States in 2009. You know, the US has 50 million mortgage holders, 24% of them were underwater. If you look at Ireland, 7 years after the onset of the global financial crisis, 40% of mortgage holders have negative equity. And, you know, if you did get a major correction in the housing market, it may well be driven by an exogenous shock or maybe driven by expectations about affordability starting to change, you know, by themselves in essence as expected returns start to reduce. Often a housing shock is accompanied by, you know, a severe economic downturn. And so that's where the major problems come. You get rising unemployment, you get low wage expectations given the pressure on the labour market. So people just get locked in to a situation where they have negative equity, fears about keeping their job, fears about what sort of income potential they have in future, and it can do enormous damage to an economy.
Damage that could spread well beyond Auckland, as Grant Robertson observed before inviting the Reserve Bank Governor to address the other big risk to the country's financial stability.
I know the focus is on housing today, but your comments around the dairy sector I mean, I guess there are two points to draw out from that that I'd like your comment on. One is you're really concentrating here on a percentage of farmers who have high debt levels and are highly leveraged. Is that the major and significant problem here, or is it the long-term or medium-term forecast for dairy payouts? Because we've been hearing that anything below $5.50 is going to present significant risk for more than just the group that you're talking about for next year's payout. If we see that in next year's payout and perhaps even beyond there, are we not looking at a risk that's much bigger than just those highly leveraged farmers?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are two issues, I think, that are really important. One is that 37% of dairy farmers have negative cash flow at the moment, given the forecast payout of $4.50. So we've seen dairy debt treble to around $34 billion since 2003, and roughly 30% of that is concentrated in the 10% most indebted farms, 50% in the 20% most indebted farms. So that's a major concern. And if you saw the dairy price just remain at low levels for a considerable period, one, that negative cash flow problem intensifies. Two, you would probably start to see dairy farm prices start to fall, which would compound the situation. So the dairy debt situation is something we look at carefully, and we've been spending a lot of time with Dairy New Zealand doing analysis on that. The other challenge is what happens, and it's related to global dairy prices, given that it's essentially such a major part of our, it's roughly a third of our merchandise exports. The spot price for whole milk powder is currently around $2,400 US a tonne. The forward market suggests that it will rise to around $2,700 US a metric tonne by the end of the year. We think the equilibrium price, if you like, that the price could settle at in the medium term is somewhere around $3,200 to $3,800 US a tonne. Because at the current prices, basically, we're two things. We're the most efficient dairy producer in the world, and a lot of dairy farmers internationally are not making money at these prices. The thing that's holding them up is the fact that cereal prices have been falling at the same time in offshore markets. So the whole situation's not sustainable. Mm. It depends very much on what happens to inventory levels in China in terms of whole milk powder, what happens to their domestic production, which seems to be increasing this year for the first time in a long time, what happens to dairy production now that the European quotas are taken off. Yeah. We're seeing more drying capacity being put into the US. And what happens with the embargoes around that Russia's imposed around dairy imports. Mm. So there's a lot of dynamics here. But if we saw another year of low prices, that would be a worry for the economy, no question. And also it would be a worry for farmers in terms of their debt capacity.
It was left to Graham Wheeler's deputy to address the worst-case scenario raised in this question from Russell Norman.
So how does it play out? So if we have another year of low prices, and so we've currently got a quarter of dairy farms are losing money, another year of a quarter of dairy farms losing money, presumably at some point they can't pay the mortgage, right? And at that point the banks are going to have to make decisions as to how they respond to large numbers of their customers unable to pay the mortgage.
Grant Spencer said that although many farmers had cash flow problems, they'd had a large payout last season.
So they can dip into those resources, they can cut investment spending, etc. And as I said, they can come to the bank for working short-term funding. So, that can continue for a period, but as you say, eventually, particularly those farmers that are highly geared, those 10% most geared farmers in particular, potentially have difficulty servicing their loans, and then there's a difficult conversation with their banker. But, from our perspective, there is some degree of optimism that, you know, farmers hate to walk away from the land. And we saw this, you know, decades ago when the farming sector was under pressure. And so they won't do it lightly, and they'll go to quite extraordinary lengths to continue to service the mortgage.
Grant Spencer, the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, ending that report from Tom Frewen on the only Select Committee meeting last week. And the lack of work in the committee rooms was a concern raised by this week's Mystery Voice.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
And it's becoming more and more arrogant. And to look at the lack of ideas, you only have to look at the thinness of this order paper.
Who is the Mystery Voice? Here he is again.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
And it's becoming more and more arrogant. And to look at the lack of ideas, you only have to look at the thinness of this order paper.
I'll be back with the identity of the Mystery Voice later in the program, after this report from Tom on preliminary skirmishes in the battle over the flag.
The battle of the flag has moved to the committee rooms, where the Justice and Electoral Select Committee is hearing submissions on a government bill preparing for two postal referendums on the New Zealand flag. The first referendum is to determine a preferred design to replace the existing one, and the second is to determine whether that alternative design should become the new flag. The order of the two referendums has itself become a major skirmish, with two political parties backing a petition calling for the order to be reversed, having a simple yes-no vote first to establish support for changing the flag, then, depending on the outcome, having a second referendum to choose the new design. The two parties supporting the petition are Labour and New Zealand First, which were the only parties to oppose giving the bill the first reading that ensured its passage through to the Select Committee, where they have followed it in hot pursuit. Labour's campaign, led by their member for Hutt South and Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard.
I think the lack of a yes-no vote, and that's what this petition is all about, is designed to bias the result. I think this is reinforced by the composition of the panel and the material released on Tuesday is all indicating a bias towards change rather than what I think should be a neutral and fair process. I want to reinforce the fact that every party represented at the cross-party group, and I acknowledge that New Zealand First was not present at that group, every party represented there other than the National Party wanted to have a yes-no vote as the first vote on the referendum process.
Trevor Mallard making a submission to the Justice and Electoral Committee on Thursday, May the 7th, adding that a decision on the flag should follow the same process as the one used to change the electoral system from first past the post to MMP.
Whether or not people voted yes or no, they had the opportunity to indicate their preference, and then there was a runoff between the winner and the current system. My view is that that system could be used for the flag and should be used for the flag. So right at the beginning is a decision about whether or not we want to have a change. I've heard a couple of people indicate that New Zealanders couldn't understand that process, that it's too complex and it's too complicated. My view is that the people who say that are insulting New Zealanders. We knew how to change our electoral system and we know how to make decisions on our flag as well.
Mr. Mallard said there were over 30,000 signatures on the petition.
They were gathered in 6 days. There was an email to my contact list. It was put up on a lot of RSA Facebook pages around the country. And the response flowed back. A similar method was used for the submissions to this committee on this legislation. You remember a lot of people submitted suggesting that there should be a yes-no vote. In that particular case, similar method out to the email, put on the Facebook pages, 11,000 people submitted that there should be a yes-no vote over a 25-hour period. I just repeat that, 11,000 submissions over 25 hours.
Trevor Mallard then defended the right of people who'd made their submission on Facebook to be heard at the committee.
Some people might think that because an RSA local page link is used to make a submission, it's somehow inferior. I don't. My view is that we've got to, as a parliament, come up to date with modern technology and methods of doing things. We've got to make things easier for people. And when 770 distinct people ask to have the right to appear and the majority of this committee decide not to, I think that harms our parliament's reputation.
Mr Mallard then took his case back into the debating chamber, using his right to ask questions of MPs in charge of bills or chairing select committees to interrogate National's Jackie Dean, who chairs the Justice and Electoral Committee.
How many people has she requested appear before the committee who submitted using the process she described as a form submission out of those who submitted using the process she described as a form submission in total?
Jackie Dean.
Thank you. None of them. The committee decided to treat 15,970 very similar emailed submissions as form submissions. The committee also decided not to hear from those form submitters who wished
order.
To be heard.
Supplementary question, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, Trevor Mallard.
In making her decision who to request to appear, did she regard people who made individual, unique submissions using links from their local RSA Facebook pages as a form submission?
Mr Speaker.
Jackie Dean.
I did not make the decision about who was to appear. The committee decided not to hear from form submitters who wished to be heard.
Question number two, Honourable Trevor Mallard.
Further to her answer to question to members number one yesterday, how many people has she requested appear before the committee who submitted using the process she described as a form submission, and how many people who made such a request has she not requested to appear?
Mr Speaker.
Jackie Dean.
None. 801 people making form submissions requested to be heard. However, it was a decision of the committee not to hear from form submitters.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Trevor Mallard.
In making her decision not to invite the 774 people who asked to speak to their submissions, did she take into account the reputational damage to this Parliament and the Select Committee process?
Mr Speaker.
Jackie Dean.
I did not make a decision not to hear from form submitters. The committee decided not to hear from form submitters who wished to be heard.
Question number three, Honourable Trevor Mallard.
Further to her answer to question to members number one yesterday, did she ascertain whether the individuals asking to appear were former services personnel by reading their submission before deciding whether or not to request their attendance?
Jackie Dean.
Thank you. No, the committee decided not to hear from form submitters. However, the committee heard from several former service personnel last week and will hear from several more this week, including a submission from the Royal New Zealand Returned Services Association on behalf of several thousand concerned New Zealanders. The committee will also be hearing from that member on behalf of 30,000 others on the same point as were made in the form submissions.
Supplementary question, Honourable Trevor Mallard.
In making her decision whether to invite over 700 submitters to give evidence, did she take into consideration whether the Select Committee process should be seen as open and listening as opposed to arrogant and predetermined?
Jackie Dean.
Mr Speaker, It was not my decision whether or not to hear from form submitters. It was a decision of the committee not to hear oral evidence from those who submitted a form submission.
After answering those questions from Labour's Trevor Mallard in the debating chamber, Jackie Dean went head-to-head with Winston Peters in the committee room, where the New Zealand First Leader complained about being limited to 5 minutes for making his submission.
Before I start, could I just say I was under the assumption that this would be at least 10 minutes, and I've heard one submitter already go that long. It's a very serious issue, and we take it deadly seriously, and we're prepared for a much briefer period than 10 minutes, but certainly not five.
Well, if I can clarify for you, you will have been notified by the clerk that you had been allocated 5 minutes. There was a submitter who was previous to you who we allocated 15 minutes to. That speaker was speaking on the petition, which is a different item of business. To be fair to every submitter, and every individual submitter in this instance has been allocated 5 minutes. So I haven't started the clock yet.
I'm asking your colleagues, is it possible to have a longer time?
Mr. Peters failed to get support, and Jackie Dean urged him to make a start on his submission.
Please get started.
Very short.
Righto. New Zealand First did not join the multi-party select committee on this. We share the Return Service Association and many other people's view. We believe a majority on this important issue. We're unequivocally against this flag change and believe the two referenda represent a gross waste of taxpayers' money when so many extraordinarily worthy causes remain unsupported at this time.
After speaking for just under 9.5 minutes, Mr. Peters wound up with a way of sabotaging the first referendum.
All opponents of this bill have to do, if the committee decides to persist with the bill, is write on their referendum paper, "We want our flag." That's all they have to do. Their vote then becomes informal, and if sufficient numbers do, that then means informals, which is after all a choice, will outnumber the next highest choice of flag design. Contemplate this. How credible then will the process be for you, your country, and indeed for the government? If the informals go out and do that, they will top your so-called next choice of design, and you will not have a credible reason to go into a second referendum. So, having put those very valid reasons before you, we expect the committee to do its duty and not recommend this bill to proceed.
Thank you very much for that submission. We do appreciate it.
Justice and Electoral Committee Chairwoman, Nationals Jackie Dean, thanking New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters for his submission on the flag referendum bill. And the committee has until the end of July to report that bill back to the chamber.
Thanks, Tom. Now, once again, here's the mystery voice.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery voice.
And it's becoming more and more arrogant. And to look at the lack of ideas, you only have to look at the thinness of this order paper.
And that's David Shearer, Labour's MP for Mount Albert, the party's former leader and now their spokesman on foreign affairs, complaining about the lack of work in the chamber and the committee rooms.
It's a government on its last legs. It's tired, it lacks ideas, it's complacent, and it's becoming more and more arrogant. And to look at the lack of ideas, you only have to look at the thinness of this order paper. And more experienced MPs in this House have said to me, they cannot remember a time when there was so little government business being put forward in this House. Even the select committees are knocking off early because there's nothing much to do. It's just not that busy, and this government is showing it has not delivered.
Labour's David Shearer, speaking in the last general debate. There'll be another one of those this Wednesday. More information and a podcast of this program on our webpage, parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Hinea Ahu, and I'll be back with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.